My name is Mary Angela DeGracia, the Tucci. I would like to welcome you here today. This is a group that we had before, and we have restarted it because there is such a need. When you get that diagnosis, you end up leaving that doctor. Here you are, diagnosis in hand, and then what do? I'm a longtime patient with multiple digestive diseases and disorders. I have from chronic idiopathic intestinal pseudoobstruction, malabsorption, pernicious anemia, gastroparesis, diffuse esophageal spasm, gastroesophageal reflux, achalasia, bladder involvement, dystonia. I have a whole host of diseases. You're not going to be tested on this. You don't have to remember this list. I'm sure many of us have a long list as well. In 1991, I had the privilege of starting the Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders. And it started out very small. We had a small board of doctors who really believed in us, and just a small group of patients. And over time, it has just mushroomed into such a huge organization. We have been, it's 25 years since we were incorporated, and I always say it's a good thing and a bad thing. And the good thing is that we've been able to serve so many people within our position around the world. The bad thing is that our organization is still needed because there are so many patients and families suffering because of digestive motility disorders. For those who are first diagnosed, you must have a million and one questions that are begging for answers. What does this test mean? You know, cure? What can I eat? Live? How do I get people to understand? How do I understand myself? How do I get help? How did this happen to me? And along with all those questions, you must have all of these emotional things that are going on, that you feel scared, you feel alone, you may feel angry, bitter, frustrated, sad, depressed. What do? All of those feelings are normal when you have a motility disorder and you're going through such challenging difficulties. So this group is specifically designed for you. We ask that when you do say something, that you just mention your first name. That way there we can match the voice to the person who is talking. You do that each time. The other thing we ask is please do not put any of your personal information out during these programs, but rather if you want to communicate with somebody or you want them to communicate with you, reach out to our organization and we can see if we'll facilitate that for you, if both parties are willing to do that. And if you have any question or have difficulty jumping in with any statement, anything you want to say because people are talking, you can always call out my name, Mary Angela, and I'll be sure to facilitate that. I'd like to open this program to you. We also have a couple of people who, we have a new volunteer here, Melissa Van Houten. Do I use the middle name, that middle Adam, every time I introduce you?
Oh, no, absolutely not necessary.
Oh, good, because your name is as long as mine. So we have on the program, she is an advocate for, I believe, 40 patient groups on Facebook. Am I correct on that, Melissa?
It's at least 40, yeah.
Upcount, and she has been willing to volunteer for our organization and has done some excellent writing, which you will be seeing a lot of. And she'll be volunteering in other capacities. She also submitted a video for our July 2016 Digestive Motility Patient Conference and did such a great job. You'll be seeing that a lot as well. In the process of redesigning on our website, so once that is done, you'll be able to see all of these materials and things that are out there. Her works are also going to be in our newsletters. We also have Julie on this call. Julie, if you facilitating the call that we had on the parent group. Julie, hi, Julie, are you here?
Good morning, yes, I'm here.
And Julie has a child with pseudo obstruction and has gone through an awful lot of work in trying to get the help for her daughter. She is in the process and hopefully nearing the end of her journey in writing a book. And Julie, I'm going to give you this opportunity just to talk a little bit about your book, because I think it's essential that though this book will eventually be published, and that it is not necessarily a how-to book. Can you talk just very quickly about that?
Sure. It's a how-not-to book, and it just talks about our journey with my daughter. Since age 2 to 14, we started going to gastro doctors at age 2 with her problems, specialty doctors at pediatric centers, large pediatric centers, which turned into going to a total of three before she was properly managed and diagnosed, and that wasn't until age 13. So the book talks a lot about our journey in managing and raising a daughter that we didn't have a proper diagnosis for, and the challenges in contending with health issues, and how that spills over into so many areas of life, including school, friends, family, trying to maintain jobs and keep up with medical bills that are staggering, and eventually getting her the help that she needs, and everything that's involved in that process. So it's just a memoir that documents our own journey, and hopefully the hope is that it can maybe be some comfort or provide some connectivity to somebody that feels very isolated in this process with their own child or with themselves.
Excellent. And everybody will know, an announcement will be made once that is finally published. In a long journey for her, a lot involved. But I think keeping a journal is so important, both as a chronicle of what you've gone through, but also as a means of therapy for what is happening. It's a life-changing thing that does happen. Julie also volunteers for our organization, has written many educational materials, and those too will be posted. She, in addition, has sent a video speaking about her journey and also about the book during our July conference, and that too was well received. So it was nice seeing, although they couldn't be at the meeting, that they could still present and communicate so eloquently, be with us via video. So on that note, I would like, first of all, just to open this up. Does anybody have a question or want to talk about their experience and or have any comment that they want to make? Anybody want to jump in? Oh, another quiet. Oh, boy. Okay. So one of the I'm wondering, how long did it take before you got a diagnosis? In my case, it was 5 years. Anybody else want to go ahead?
Do you want me to talk about Elise's?
Sure. That's Julie. Yes.
Okay. So this is Julie. I live in Southern California. So we're right in the middle of three very reputable pediatric centers. And I started taking my daughter to a gastro specialist without really the support of her primary pediatrician. She didn't really recognize her chronic constipation as a significant problem, and I felt it impacted our life enough for several months for me to seek the help of a specialist. And she was about 2 years old at the time, and we got in front of this doctor. She deemed the problem she had as behavioral. I described her symptoms and her behavior and how she felt when she wasn't able to go to the bathroom, and it was diagnosed as a functional constipation issue that my daughter did on purpose. So that was how she was treated and how I approached my child for about 8 years, and until she, it wasn't until she started having other health issues, large joint arthritis and some other things that prompted us to keep moving. And unfortunately, I didn't do that until she was about 10 years old. We got in front of another gastro center, gastro specialist that also agreed with the first and the pediatrician, and then we ended up at Children's Hospital, Los Angeles. And that's when the situation was very bad by that point. And I had a little one, about 11 years old. She weighed about 50 pounds and was a failure to thrive, malnourished, had large joint arthritis and some other things that were directly attributed to the directly related to the intestinal issues that, that they felt were severe. So we went from thinking that this is a behavioral problem that she should have some more control over to this problem that they initially thought would was probably celiac, although it was never confirmed. Lots of tests and a process that we didn't finish because we were anxious to start her on a gluten-free diet, which did help for a time, and then she even failed in that, and then she was deemed as having a motility problem. We got in front of a gastromotility specialist. There's just very few in the whole country. And that's when things moved even more in a different direction. She was very ill by that point. Now, then she weighed about in the 60s, and she was 13 and very sick. And so she was recommended for an appendectomy surgery, which she's had twice, which is an alternate to a colostomy bag where they can construct a stoma through the appendix open line to have the child catheterize at home and force a flush at home to make the intestines do their job. So that's what she does now. It has been life-changing, although the surgery was fairly easy, but the process at home was a bit harrowing at first. And it took our little family some time to get on board with agreeing to this. So it was such a very drastic step. So, but it has been life-changing, and what's been life-changing even more was getting in front of the right doctors that could properly diagnose and really viewed this as a problem that recognized that that she was unwell. So it wasn't just that she was thin or that she didn't like going to the bathroom or that she didn't have an appetite. It was much more serious than that, and to the point where it affected her growth and overall health and development. So we struggled with this from age 2 to 13, and that's how long it took to get diagnosed. And you can imagine the frustration, medical bills, and time involved in that journey.
Definitely, and I know that we use the word motility, and where you are diagnosed, if most on this call, I'm wondering, because I get this question all the time, well, what does motility mean? What do you mean I have a motility disorder? And the word motility just means movement or motion. When you have normal digestion, that what is called peristalsis, or wave-like contractions, that you have no all over, and those waves move food and liquid throughout your digestive tract. When you have a motility disorder, those contractions become less efficient. So in some cases, you may have rapid movement. Diarrhea would be an example of that. You may have very slow. Constipation can be that. You can have a combination of both. In severe cases, you can have total absence of those contractions, and in other cases, go in reverse. Think of it is, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have motility problems within your entire tract. Some people have it in the stomach. Some people may have it in the lower intestine, upper. And in some cases, it progresses, and in other cases, it does not. What we find with motility disorders is it's very individual in nature. So patients may not totally present the same way. And in addition, what works for one patient may not work for another. So those are just some key things. Anybody want to jump in on that? No. Melissa, go ahead.
I was just going to say that word motility was never used until, you know, Elise was 13 years old. So just, if that word just would have been used early on, even if it wasn't used really specifically to diagnose, if it was just said, if it was just verbalized, I think your child has a motility issue, it might have led to me doing some more research. I didn't even know such a word was really connected with the function of the bowel or non-function. And certainly once that term was used and she got in front of the doctor that specialized in that, which is a sub-specialty of a gastro doctor, of course, that's when things turned around. So that word wasn't even used in all the years, in the decade that we spent with the gastro doctor. That word wasn't even used at all. Very late in our journey.
Yeah, they also use dysmotility, D-Y-S, motility, the same thing, where they say you have dysmotility, but where? What part of the intestinal tract? And that's an important thing, too, just to know that. So it's a process. Melissa, how long did it take you to be diagnosed?
Well, now, don't hate me, because I'm not typical.
Oh, I couldn't hate you.
I actually was, I woke up having symptoms one morning that I had never had in the past, and really, really violent vomiting, nonstop vomiting, and just excruciating pain. And I went to the emergency room. And as it turns out, it's probably the best thing that could have happened to me, because they admitted me and they gave me all sorts of tests over the course of a week. And at the end of the week, they diagnosed me with gastroparesis. And I'm convinced that I just would not have had that opportunity had I not gone through the emergency room, because, you know, it takes a long time to get in with a gastro doctor sometimes and get all those tests performed. But because I went through the emergency room, I got them very quickly and got an answer very quickly.
Wow. And that is fortunate, because oftentimes when we go to emergency, in my experience, they don't have an idea. So the fact that it was just right, everything was lined up to you, is huge.
Absolutely.
And some background noise here.
Yeah.
I'll be muting people. Don't be offended. It's just to find out.
I just want to say I'm on the line, but it sounds as though you're breaking up a lot.
Oh, that figures. Yeah, I was having trouble with this earlier for the other call. So there's not much I can do, and I don't understand why that keeps happening, but I'll do my best. Are you hearing it now still?
Yes, you're fine now.
Okay. It comes and goes, so there's no way to track that. But I can hear an echo, and usually that's a sign that there's a problem with the reception, whether it's from our end, use WebEx as our service, whether it's on their end. I don't know. Anybody else want to jump in?
Well, since I'm already jumped in, I may as well. This is Candy again. I was not aware of this particular disease, the gastroparesis, at all. I had, probably, I don't remember, 3 or 4 years ago, had a colonoscopy, which was fine. And I scheduled an appointment with my gastroenterologist, and because I was having a lot of nausea. And the reason I did not continue was because they insisted I pay the full amount up front. And I said, but we have insurance, you know. So anyway, we just, you know, they expect you to have disposable income, I guess, at your hand. So I then just put up with it. I took Phenergan for 2 or 3 years quite frequently. I finally went back to, I made an appointment with the same guy, and we have him out here once a week. We live kind of out in the sticks, and he comes from Jacksonville, which is, you know, a larger area. And we did the test. Well, first he did an endoscopy and found I had a esophageal ulcer right underneath, like sort of my rib cage area, but it was in my esophagus. And he gave me some medicine for that, and then we did another one 6 weeks later, and it was gone. And then he was hoping, I think, that that would create, you know, stop the nausea, and it didn't. And so then we did the stomach emptying test, and that's when he determined, you know, because of that. But mine is a very mild case. I hardly feel like I belong because, you know, I don't have tubes in me and stuff like that like I've been seeing. So my main concern is trying to find – I don't cook much, and it's just me and my husband. And I don't – it's hard to find food that you can eat. It's like all white. You know, my plate, it's either all white or beige. In other words, I'm not getting nourished. So maybe someone can help there.
Yeah, anybody want to make a comment or suggestion?
Well, this is Sandra. I started using the Glucerna. Of course, I'm a diabetic.
What is that called?
Glucerna. But if you're not a diabetic, you could use Ensure.
Oh, okay.
This is Julie. My daughter's been on lots of different formulas. There are some available. Sometimes the nutrition department within the hospital has even better recommendations than the gastro doctor, so if they can connect you with a nutritionist or a dietitian within the hospital setting, they recommend lots of things for malnutrition. Usually it's a variety of formulas. Sometimes they even resort to real specialized baby formula type of things to add to, mm-hmm. like shakes and drinks and things, and so my daughter's been on a variety of those. Some are quite expensive, but if you can mm-hmm. get on a program usually within the hospital setting, sometimes they'll sell you those supplies at cost. So whereas a thing like Glucerna or Boost, it may sell at Target or Walmart for, like, I don't know, between $9 and $12 for a small case. Like, I don't know, 6 or 9 is in a case where I can get an entire case of, like, 24 for $5.
Wow.
So if you have to do that and have to rely on that for your nutritional support, you can sometimes obtain those through a hospital program that specializes in catering to those with nutritional needs.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, lived quite a ways from that area of the world, and I don't drive that often, so.
Are you near, how far are you from a hospital?
Well, we have one out here, but it's kind of like rinky-dink, you know. There's none of the big doctors are in it. It's basically, like for an ER-type setting, and then they send you on to the big hospital.
Well, just contact the big hospital and see what can be arranged. We make a trip.
Yeah.
If we may have to go get formula, we do make a day trip of it. It is far for us. Maybe not as far as you, but it involves getting into downtown LA, which I don't like to go to. So we make a trip, and I just buy several cases at a time that'll last us for several months.
Well, does that stuff cover, like, your green vegetables and things that we're not eating anymore?
No, it doesn't. So it's usually high calorie count, a lot of them are high sugar, high, you know, fat, which is
uh-huh.
just, you know, getting in the calories, which is what my daughter needed.
And I don't need the calories.
Yeah.
I don't need them.
I don't know. You'd have to get a recommendation from between the dietitian and the doctor. see what they'd really recommend.
Yeah, okay. I want to just, I'm sorry, I just tell you that the rule of thumb is, that echo again, that rule of thumb is that you should be eating slowly, have multiple meals, mini meals, what I call grains throughout the day, avoid fiber, gassy foods, and avoid fatty foods. That's the general rule of thumb. Again, it's individual.
Right.
So for some people that works. But I know patients juice different things, fruits, vegetables, find that helps. Baby food helps.
Yeah.
And finding things that are, I know it's bland, but that nutrition is key. So if you are seeking help from a dietitian, it's important to find a dietitian that specializes, again, in motility. Because on that's just a diet, and I say just, and I shouldn't, but if you're getting the one who specializes in just general nutrition, you're going to get that other thing that you can print off the internet. If your guest is affected by solids versus liquids, that's going to be different than if you have the opposite, liquids versus solids, or you have a combination of both. I don't know the answer to what you are going to.
Well, they just handed me a half sheet of paper, just a half sheet now, and the basic principle at the top said think soft foods.
Yeah.
And no raw vegetables, leafy or stringy vegetables or nuts.
This is more of a...
Are a couple of things too, and one is the University of Virginia has a very good site, Gastroparesis, where they... Reese Parrish is the woman who does dietitian nutrition there. They have a lot of good material up there.
Through the University of Virginia?
Yes.
In fact, I think that's... They go check as we're talking. Somebody else wanted to jump in?
Yeah, this is Melissa.
Go right ahead.
Hi. I had that kind of situation as well. I was handed a piece of paper that said something about low fiber, low fat, eat lots of times. And of course, I went home and was unable to keep down water, so that was less than helpful. after I started being able to eat a little bit, I started with something called kefir, which is a drinkable yogurt. And it has a lot of probiotics in it and a lot of protein. That helped me. There are also some drinks out there like the Ensure that you can get that are that they don't have sugar in them and they have less calories. So you might look into that. Ensure actually has a light formula if you're looking for fewer calories and lots of protein still. And that Virginia site is really, really helpful. It is uvahealth.com, and you should be able to find the diet on there.
Okay.
Great, thanks. Melissa, can you spell that? It's K-A...
Oh, kefir? Yeah, it's K-E-F-I-R.
Oh, I know what that is. That's a like a health food kind of thing.
It's in the health stores, but it is actually in some of the grocery stores now, like the main grocery stores, because it's become so popular.
not out here.
Really?
I live in the southern part of Florida. I'm in North Florida, but this particular county, they haven't decided to eat anything other than fried foods and whatnot.
Oh, my. Well, I know some people who make their own, but I can't really recommend that because that's beyond my energy abilities, let me tell you.
Thank you.
Anybody else want to jump in? Question, comment, want to share your experience?
I have a question. Mine being mild, will it get worse? Or is it just going to be mild?
Individual in nature, it depends. Again, in some patients, it can progress. Some patients their gastroparesis does get worse, and then it can also affect esophagus. In other patients, it just remains. In fact, we have some patients who they have that for a while, and then suddenly it goes into a remission, and patients feel that they're cured. And then suddenly, maybe a year, 2 years, even 5 years, I'll get a call, and they'll say, I'm calling again because, and it has come back. But other patients, it just has disappeared. So in answer to your question, it's very individual. Nobody can answer that because it is so individual. Good question, though, and it's one I get all the time. And that's
Thank
the
you.
Answer that I give. Melissa, do you have anything to add to that, or Julie?
No, my daughter's condition is pseudo obstruction, so she is able to eat. Her food would process and then just rot in her bowels, but it did eventually lead to malnutrition. So that's where the formula having to be introduced, and even beyond the surgery, she still continues on formula today and different things to increase in her appetite. But over and over, the shakes were recommended, and so you know with whatever. And that was a big variety of things. I know that you can get through different nutritional resources, you know, the green mixtures and different things that supposedly have some vegetable content in them and make shakes out of them, flavor mm-hmm. them with whatever else you can have, you know, whether it's almond milk or berries or coconut milk or whatever you can mm-hmm. you can keep down. But they've tried a variety of things with her to simply get her nutrition up and her weight up. So that's what we've done. So she doesn't have the problem of being able to keep food down. It was more of a problem with absorption and the processing of it once it was already mm-hmm. in. So, but, you know, the shakes and the liquid form of any sort was always what they and continue to push.
Okay.
Because it's so much easier to break down.
And the other thing, too, is just to know with gastroparesis patients as well as other motility disorders, you may find that on one day you're able to consume that or something, and then mm-hmm. you to do that fine, and then you may have that same thing that next week or another month, and then you see the reaction. So it's not unusual for it always to be like a trial and error. And in addition, it might be that the repertoire of foods get smaller and smaller, which is why it's so critical that nutrition, and this is even based on my personal experience, is critical no matter what age you are. If you don't have that nutrition, the proper nutrition, your body can't function right. And then you're going to have other problems related to nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
Any comments? Jump in.
I'll call you before I get anything.
I'm hearing something.
That was my husband.
So what was recommended to my daughter and still is sort of in the background of the doctor's thinking is a G-tube. So, of course, nobody wants that. But if she couldn't maintain weight and couldn't make progress on the formula, G-tube feeding was the next step. In fact, I think she kind of wanted that for my daughter when she had the appendicostomy, but she broke it up into two separate processes, and we've held off on doing the other because she's just horrified at it. But, you know, she sees only the benefits of it, and, of course, the doctor approaches things from her perspective of, okay, here's the problem, here's what fixes it, and there's quite a bit of stress involved in eating and gaining weight and taking in enough calories, and there's a daily struggle with the child and getting them to cooperate with that and on. And all that ends, in her eyes, all that ends if you just do the G-tube. The taking in of the nutrients and the daily struggles with food and the body's inability to absorb it and process it all stops with the G-tube. So, unfortunately, I'm on the other end of the spectrum with a daughter who is horrified by this suggestion and is very aware of what that might look like socially and with friends and is isolating and different and all that.
Well, you say she's 13?
She's 15. So that's been recommended
15.
For the last 2 years. So we've held off on that by just using formula and such at home. But really and truly, the doctor would be happier if we would just do the G-tube and feed her formula 23 hours a day.
Wow.
Yeah, and I think most kids with the condition she has have G-tubes, from what I've read.
Mm.
Well, I think,
I'm sure I'm glad you got some help.
Yes,
yeah.
Me too.
Oh, it's so important, too, to not be, so you have a diagnosis, now what do you do with it? And I know when you leave the doctor's office and there you are living your life for hours a day with this diagnosis in hand, one of the key things is to educate yourself. Read as you can, learn about it. And I just, I'm a believer in education because it arms you with the information you need and it helps making decisions in your medical care. The other thing is to not be submissive. Julie, give me that phrase that you use all the time.
Pushy but polite. So it's when you insist on your way or push for your way or what you need with a big fat smile on your face and you're cordial and sweet as you command it. So, you know, I feel like you should have a stay in the medical process with yourself or with your child and assert yourself for what you need. And, you know, rather than putting the doctor on the defensive about what their stand is, I, you know, truly believe in treating the whole person is so important, especially with a child, because they're so aware of being different and don't want the label of being sick and so on. Nobody does, but, you know, I've had to, by trial and error and doing things the wrong way for a long time, learn that I have every right to speak up and to, you know, we're paying for a service that I want, and we should have a say in how this is managed if there's at all options. And you would do that with any illness. You would say, okay, I'm willing to do this, but not that, or I'd prefer this instead of that, or what are the alternatives? What are my options? What else can I do? What would you do with me if I was your, if this was your daughter or your wife or your, you know, your sister, what would you do? And so I routinely ask those sorts of questions with doctors instead of just, you know, going to, you know, what's in the book and what's next to recommend, what else is there? And I don't know, I found that sort of softened their approach a bit and humanized the care because it's not just a patient, it's a person that mm-hmm. has feelings and a life and thoughts and, you know, a life outside of being ill or wants to have a life outside of being ill. So my daughter's doctor is very much in the mindset that of taking control of the condition instead of the condition controlling you. And so by making some steps and some changes that, although might be uncomfortable, it might empower you to get past a bad point and then move on to another step and even change things a bit. So she sort of approaches things like, okay, well, why don't we do this now and see how this does for 6 months and then revisit the idea again. So it might just be a continual morphing of the process and the treatment and what is, you know, where you're at the time. So that's what we've learned.
That's an excellent point. The other thing is, we talked about this during the parent program, but I think this is so important. The impact that this can have on finances is huge. And a lot of people are governed by the insurance, and as a result of that, they have to kind of fight tooth and nail, or they get that rejection notice that your payment for that appointment or the test is going to be horrendous. Julie, can you talk a little bit, because I think this is such an essential thing. I hear this all the time. Can you talk a little bit about the insurance part?
So I don't know about everybody else on the phone, but my husband works for a large corporation that went from having co-pays and deductibles that were very manageable and met within the first month or two
of treatment, were like a $250 deductible or even a $500 deductible. I remember being horrified when our deductible increased to $500. Now it's about $5,000. And so once healthcare started changing in the country, large corporations also adjusted their programs, and what was once available became so unaffordable, even through a large corporation. My husband works for Nestle, which is a huge food company. Outside the U.S., so they're a huge company, but even their coverage, the coverage remained the same, but the co-pays and co-insurance and deductibles were multiplied by about 10 times. And so, unfortunately, that peaked at the point where we were, had some really intense treatment with my daughter, and it continued into six calendar years. And so we had a large deductible and then a large out-of-pocket co-pay or co-insurance max, which was met consistently every year over six calendar years. So it would be between $5,000 and $8,000 times six.
Wow.
And that's what we managed. We did manage it, but I learned to negotiate like a used car salesman, and mostly with entities that we left behind. So if we kept moving and did not stay with the same pediatric medical system and yet had large bills that lingered, I didn't miss payments on them, and I didn't ignore them. I always kept in touch, but I learned to negotiate those bills. So as a rule of thumb, I paid all the small ones and made sure doctors' bills were paid, and I negotiated with the larger ones, which are mainly hospitals and sometimes labs. Those are large billion-dollar entities that can afford to make cuts, even if you have an insurance contract with them, with your employer. So a lot of people are hesitant to do that, or most of the time the first thing out of their mouth is, we've already cut this bill because of your contract with the insurance. And my response to that was always, it has nothing to do with me. Whatever you've contracted with insurance companies, you're doing it across the board with many insurance companies so that you get patients, so that you get business, so that your doors are open. So what you can either negotiate with me and we can settle this bill, I'm going to pay you $20 a month for the next 7 years. So some of them, I am paying $25 a month and have done so for 5 or 6 years, and but the vast majority of them negotiated and settled. So, of course, you have to have a little bit of funds to do that, and you have to be willing to ask those questions, especially if that's against your – that might be intimidating if it's against your grain or your nature. It was on my end at first, but I felt I could – I discovered I could be pretty – assertive over the phone and or in writing. And so every time I put myself out there to ask those questions, 9 times out of 10, I got something back from them that said, we'll work with you. We'll settle with you. What can you give? And I let them start the negotiating number first. Give me your number, and let's start there. And it was usually 50 to 60% or below. So, and for the, like I said, the entities that would negotiate, you're going to get $25 a month from me. And then I even negotiate on those to not charge interest. So I don't care if they hit my credit. There's nothing that can appear on your credit other than you're paying. So there's nothing that's really going to damage your credit if you're making a regular monthly payment. What are they going to report? So don't be too intimidated by the threat that this is going to go to collections or this is going to go on your credit. What's going to go on your credit? That you're paying every month? So I learned to quickly sort of decipher what mattered and what didn't matter. What really mattered is keeping food in my fridge, pay the mortgage, and the medical bills were somewhere after that. Unfortunately, I had to prioritize things in my own household. So, you know, for the first time, I negotiated those things.
Excellent. Excellent. Melissa, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I agree with that. I've actually negotiated some bills down myself, and a lot of hospitals will have a program where you can just fill out a form online asking for help with your bills, asking for some relief. And if you are uncomfortable talking to them, writing is the way to go, because you can sit in front of your document until you feel comfortable with how it's worded and send it via email or the postal service. And you know, you can really tell them everything you want to tell them without having the stress of being, you know, on the phone and I have to come up with the right words right now. So I would say if you're intimidated, yeah, go the written route. They'll still pay attention to you. They want their money and they'll be willing to talk to you.
And honestly, most of the time, I dealt with very kind people. As soon as I had a child that was combating a long-term serious illness, that disarms a nasty collector right away. And sometimes I even said, have you ever been sick? Do you have kids? Do you have a parent that's been ill? Have you ever been in the hospital?
Wow.
Each admission is between $60,000 and $100,000, at least in our case. So, and to walk in front of these doctors at large pediatric facilities, it's $1,000 to get an appointment. So, I was not intimidated anymore. I felt like I would sometimes line up what they'd been paid. What doctors had been paid that didn't help my daughter. And so, you know, a little bit of anger fueled, but I was always polite. And if I got somebody nasty, I could absolutely keep up. But I preferred not to go that way, and for the most part have not had to. But I tell you, if someone was nasty with me or wouldn't negotiate a bill, they were bumped to the bottom of my list, and I told them so. You can be at the top, and I can pay you first, or you're going to be number 13 on my medical bill list. So you decide where you want to be and then review that with your supervisor. And by the way, who is your supervisor? And then I'd contact them.
You sound like you're a wonderful advocate for your daughter, / pit bull.
I know my husband asked me some time ago, what happened to the nice Julie that I married?
It's so important. And the way Julie is with her daughter, saying all patients should be in their own care. And if you're too sick or too timid, have somebody who you trust, probably a family member, who will help in advocating for you. I know there are privacy laws, but if you give permission for that person to represent you in some of the calls, sometimes what they do is they want to talk to you first, and then you give them permission over the phone or via letter, and then that person can assist. You may have to do it every time you call. The other thing is to be sure you have copies of your medical records. And Melissa, maybe you want to talk more about that.
Absolutely. The more that you can get together and organized before you go to the doctor's appointment, the better off you will be. If you've had surgeries in the past or you've had recent appointments, if you could get copies of those records, that would be great. If you've kept any kind of diary about, well, you know, when I eat at this time or I eat this food, I have this symptom. If you have any kind of diary like that that you can kind of summarize quickly in a sheet and take that in, that would be great. If you can write down questions, specific questions that you have for the doctor ahead of time and just take a sheet of, you know, three or four questions, the main questions that you might have, so that you can take those in, that's good. Because a lot of times you go into the doctor's office and you think you know what you're going to say, but then you get there and you're tired and your mind is racing and he's hitting you with a million facts and you cannot remember the questions you wanted to ask him. So if you have it written down, you know, you can just look at your sheets. And I find anything you can do to organize that material ahead of time really, really helps, because it takes you less time to present it to the doctor, and he has limited time. And, you know, they kind of look at you differently, too. They say, well, this woman's interested in taking care of her health. Look at all she's done to prepare for this appointment.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I started going with a little medical timeline because my daughter's records became so daunting when we would switch
doctors, it became this big stack of stuff for them to review, and a lot of it was just repetitive, you know, follow-up visits, but some of it I was concerned that they may not read thoroughly through because it was so big.
Yeah.
And so I started doing a timeline, and surprisingly, instead of the doctor being, you know, irritated that I, you know, maybe went to that extent, every one of them appreciated it and was glad that it was sort of summarized right in front of them, and that they didn't have to thumb through 6 or 8 years of visits and tests and things. I had it all in the timeline. And then I did find that if a doctor did rush me or seemed in a hurry, I would hold up my finger and say, I'm not done yet. I'm not quite done. I have 3 more questions, and I'd rattle them off. And I don't know, every time they sort of chuckled, I smiled and I was polite about it, but I made it very clear that they were going to work for me for that 12 minutes that they were going to give me that I waited 8 weeks to get in front of them for. So it doesn't mean I wasn't nervous and doesn't mean I wasn't intimidated by it, but I still did it. And every time I did it and every time I spoke up or stood up, I felt a little more empowered for the next time.
Right. Ladies, I'm going to have to get off now, but thank you so much. This is Candy for all the information.
Thank
you, Candy.
Thank you, Candy.
Another thing is, I know when I go to the doctor, I go with the people described. I have my lists. I have my allergies, injuries, medicines, all of this information, why I'm there, the questions. But I literally write down answers while the doctor is talking. If I have any questions. So important. Some doctors allow patients to record. I, on the other hand, choose to write. And one other thing, I ask questions. If the doctor is saying something to me and a little bit unsure of the understanding, I will actually say to that doctor, can you repeat that again? And the doctor should repeat it a different way. If the doctor doesn't and you're still confused, then what I say is that my understanding that what you are saying is this. And I don't leave and jump to the next question until I understand what was just being said. If I have to have a test, I want to know, what is this test for? What does it entail? Is this going to be something that I have to take a prep for? How long is this test? When will I get the results? And look at the results of your medical tests, because that's important too. Doctors only have a limited amount of time, sometimes even radiologists, they overlook just one thing that may be a little bit off, but they think it's not significant. Or the doctor may, because mistakes are made, sometimes just overlook something. So it's up to you. If you don't understand those results, ask the nurse practitioner, all of those other people who are involved in medical care, or ask the doctor. Because if you're taking these tests, paying for them, and you are taking the time to go to appointments, leave there more confused than when you started. Not a good appointment. It's up to you to kind of help steer that appointment so that you understand what is going on to the best that you can. Because sometimes you have to understand when you just have a new diagnosis, you have to ask, I want. So just remember, this appointment is for you, not for them. It's for you, or it's for your child, or your other relative. Anybody else want to comment on that or jump to something else? Go ahead. Did I just hear somebody say something and then all of a sudden disappear? Oh, no, don't have to. Both Melissa and Julie advocate in different ways. Melissa advocates especially on Facebook groups. How she does it, I don't know, in over 40. And Julie advocates for her child, but in doing so, both individuals are helping to teach others about some of the mistakes they made and things that work and how to empower people so that you are not a victim, but you are a victor in your journey with your emotional.
And I feel
Angela.
Like,
I just want to say, you know, I don't know how long ago everybody on this call was diagnosed, but I can tell you, you know, I've been diagnosed for about 2.5 years, a little more than 2.5 years now. And I was incredibly scared and lost when I was first diagnosed. I'd never heard the word gastroparesis. I didn't have much information when I left the hospital. And I really thought I was going to die. I mean, I was so sick that I really thought I was going to die. I actually went so far as to write my family letters telling them that I wasn't going to make. So if you're like that and you're scared out there, don't give up, because you will adjust to this. I know you think that you won't, but it doesn't stay like this. You will learn. And even if you screw up royally at those first doctor visits, you will get better. You will get used to it. You will find information if you want it. And you will be able to speak for yourself. So I know it may seem really bad at first, but I'm telling you, there's help out there. And there are people who are willing to help you if you can't do it for yourself. So hang in there.
This is Julie. I agree with that. And I have to say that I wasn't always a bulldog at doctor's appointments, and I didn't always speak up. I spent years of doing things wrong and beating myself up after doctor's appointments and even thinking of all the things I should have said after the fact. And then I beat myself up even more that I hadn't spoke up, or that I left with no answers and had to wait another 2 months before I got in front of this doctor again. So, and a lot of times how I started the conversations off with these doctors was, oh, gosh, you make me so nervous. Oh, I'm so nervous today. Or I have several questions. I hope we can take a few minutes to get through them. And that seemed to sort of mentally prepare the doctor, because they're also coming in the door with their own agenda, what they want to discuss, what they want to get out, and a preconceived idea of how much time they're going to spend with you and what they have coming up next after you. So I just found that if I, again, was a little more prepared and humanized the visit by telling the doctor how rattled I was or how frustrated I was or nervous or whatever, it seemed to go smoother if I just at least acknowledged that. And you know, I think most of the time the doctor was sort of pleasantly surprised and glad that the patient was, that I was engaged in the appointment instead of just sitting there, just having him feed me whatever information he had or didn't have.
And the other thing I want to highlight is that you are not alone. You have this organization as well. Notice how I worded that. You have this organization. Is about all of you and for all of you. And we have different programs as this, but we have other ones and educational materials. If you have any questions, concerns, you're shy about participating in these programs, or this is new and you just wanted to listen in, whatever it may be, call, you can email, and we're here to serve you. You're not alone. We understand. I'm sure through this call there were a lot of people who were bobbing their heads up and down going, yep, I've done that. I understand. Or I'm scared. And I think all of us have been scared. Sometimes probably are still scared. There are times when I'm even frightened. But with all those experiences, it's you become your own advocate, which is essential in this medical system. On that note, run out of time. I say this, I like to close these programs like I typically do, that all of you on this call, first of all, I want to thank Julie and Melissa especially for their contributions, essential and excellent, helpful information. So thank you both.
Thank you. I do appreciate it.
No problem.
The other is that you are all heroes. What you are going through, I'm sure you have countless challenges, social part, the financial part, processing everything that you're going, that emotional part, the food issue, the bathroom issues, the what if in your life. You understand that. You are all heroes. When this program ends, you are not forgotten. I keep you in my prayers. I respond to these calls. Just really pray that you get that guidance, that you feel support. You feel these and phone call hugs that we're giving you. And know that we are yours. We are here for you. And there is help available. Any help you need, we can give you that information. And I hope that for the rest of the day, that this is one of your better days and you can process everything that we've said and take away some benefit from it. May God bless you all. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Mary Angela. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Mary Angela.
Thank you, Mary Angela.